welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public, this Wednesday edition. I'm Craig Blumenschein. On today's show, we'll talk with Dr. Michael Taylor and Bobby Gray Eagle, the Convocation Forum Speaker, ahead of the 4th Annual Black Elk Forum and Convocation, starting Monday, October 7th at the University of Mary. My former colleague Ashley Thornburg will stop by the studio to preview tomorrow's Humanities ND Brave Conversations event with Kate Bowler, and Rick Guillon joins me to chat about regional apple festivals and the joys of the harvest season in our Prairie Plates segment. But first, we begin today's show with Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University as he reflects on approaching his 1,000th Plains Folk essay. And what a gift that has been to Prairie Public. In this thoughtful reflection, Dr. Ezern celebrates his family farm's sesquicentennial and 50 years of teaching history and his continued journey in studying the Great Plains.
Sometime soon, I will come to Prairie Public Studios and record Plains Folk radio feature number 1,000. I'm not winding down, but ramping up toward that recording, wherein I will, of course, offer some wise and witty remarks about life on the Great Plains of North America and the enterprise of telling their stories. Actually, I find myself approaching this milestone with joy, but also introspection and humility. This is the same year we celebrated the sesquicentennial, 150th anniversary, of our family farm. The same year, too, that Dr. Kelly and I observed, quietly, my run of 50 years as a professional historian. It's a lot to process. My response, so as not to ramble on aimlessly, is to redouble my reading in history and folklore, and especially the regional identity of the Great Plains. Which brings me to this new anthology, courtesy University of Nebraska Press, Reconsidering Regions in an Era of New Nationalism, edited by Alexander Finkelstein and Anne F. Hyde. This is a pretty dense academic work, but the ideas in it are accessible and important. As the editors say, regional identification is ripe for historical analysis because it is so pertinent to collective and personal identity. To my life on the plains, as another memoirist once said. Leading off is the scholar Jennifer Rittenhouse with an essay on Southern identity. She acknowledges that Southern regionalists have a double problem, the original sin of slavery and the compounding sin of denial, the lost cause and all that. Also, that sense of grievance, often aggressive, nursed through the generations. Surely this has nothing to do with life on the plains, right? Actually, I recently wrote, quoting the Book of Acts, about our need to acknowledge the field of blood in our own history, so that we can progress to a positive narrative of place in the land. As for grievance, well, turn off Prairie Public for a few minutes and tune in a commercial station, and what do you hear? I took a lot of notes from Rittenhouse, as well as from Lawrence Culver, whose contribution is The Significance of Climate in American History. He recounts the 19th century struggle over the identity and image of the plains, Great American Desert, or Garden of the World. This matters not only in the broad strokes of branding, but also in the granular composition of grassland memory. That's why, when historian Molly Rosen seems preoccupied with the subject of going barefoot on the prairies, I nod my head, maybe even drop a tear. Americans might have thought they were done with climate, writes Culver, but climate is not done with them. A few years ago, at a conference in Norway, I broached the subject of not climate, but climate change as a historical determinant of life on the plains. Now, the idea has wheels, historically. As for other things not done with us, see the essay by Courtney E. Bukowski, Growing Up American, detailing the history of New York's Children's Aid Society. I always thought this group gathered up orphans and brought them to the prairies for a chance in life. Now I learn that many of these orphans were Irish or other Catholic kids taken forcibly from their families. Yes, my native friends, I know this sounds familiar. It makes me think also about other possibly similar cases. What about mail order brides? Not just the stuff of TV movies, I suspect. Well, give me another 50 years, because I've got a lot to think about and talk with you about.
That was Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Stay tuned for his milestone 1,000th Plainsfolk essay coming in just a few weeks here on Main Street. Up next, a preview of the 4th Annual Black Elk Forum and Convocation at the University of Mary. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, visiting in front of the 4th Annual Black Elk Forum and Convocation at the University of Mary. The events run from Monday, October 7th through Friday, October 11th. With me to discuss is Dr. Michael Taylor, Professor of Education and Director of Catholic Studies for the Graduate Education Program at the University of Mary. Dr. Taylor, welcome back to Main Street.
Good to be back. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're sure welcome. And also with us is Bobby Gray Eagle. He's a Dakota man and a featured speaker at the University of Mary's Black Elk Convocation and Forum. He'll share his personal encounters with the story of Lakota Servant of God, Black Elk. Bobby, welcome to Main Street. It's a pleasure to meet you.
The feeling is mutual. It's good to be here.
Dr. Taylor, let me start with you first, if I could, please. What inspired the University of Mary to create the Black Elk Convocation and Forum? And tell me how it's evolved over the past 4 years.
Yeah, that's a big question and a good one. I think the inspiration is the fact that Black Elk, or as some would know him as Nicholas Black Elk, had a conversion experience in his midlife to Catholicism. So he would be in the process of canonization. And so this, as a Catholic Christian and Benedictine institution, University of Mary, this would be of interest, of course, because this would be a person, along with many, many other saints, that would have some type of story in relation to the type of institution that we are. So, and I think because of the area that we live in and the people who have and continue to contribute in significant ways to the area, namely Lakota and other people, this would be an important story for us to not only keep forward and present to the people, especially as Black Elk being an example of cultural healing, I think, in a lot of ways. But also just for us to keep that understanding of the culture that was present and is still present here in our very community, along with other cultural groups, especially with a Native American background. So all these things, I think, unfolded is what inspired the Black Elk Convocation and Forum. And I think also it's just one of our roles. You know, one of our calls at the University of Mary is to the community and beyond. So this is a significant part of our community, so it makes sense that we would host the dialogue around a significant person like Black Elk, but in general of cultures, and cultures in particular to our area, which would be Black Elk's culture of Lakota people.
Bobby, you'll be speaking at the event on Thursday, October 10th, and then again Friday, October 11th. Introduce yourself to us, if you would, Bobby. Why is this event important to you to come to the University of Mary?
Yeah. Well, I will introduce myself in Dakota way. So, how, midako yepi, ehana wo daku yepi ki, amakiapi, Bismarck, North Dakota, Edwati, toka nua, South Dakota, hechia to'oho wahi, wanietu ikchemina dopa, some, boy. I forgot how to say 50, but I just turned 50, so if I said that right, it was hello, my relatives. My name is the long ago ancestor, also known as Bobby Gray Eagle. I live in Bismarck, North Dakota, and I come from Enemy Swim, South Dakota, and I am 50 winters. So the importance is right now in this time of human history, when it just seems that everyone is just kind of digging their heels in, where whatever they're leaning, whatever their paradigm, they're just digging their heels in. And I think that this Lakota holy man, this relative from the council, from the seven council fires, the Titouan, has a lot to teach us. You know, I think that if we would look at what how he navigated it among our Jesuit brothers and sisters, our Catholic brothers and sisters, we could see things that we can apply to our lives today and see that, you know, sometimes less is more, you know. I think that if even my own tribe, I come from a Sistine Wapton Dakota Oyate, small community called Enemy Swim, South Dakota, and I remember my mother taking us to a place called the Blue Cloud Abbey in South Dakota there, and it was just a huge facility, and they were Benedictine monks and nuns there. And so there's a relatedness there with the Catholic, those relatives that would call themselves Catholic. I would just say that if our relative, a holy man, could see value among our Catholic relatives, I think that we as Native people here in North America, we should be paying attention to that. We should see that maybe this old way needs to be recaptured again, and we need to go into those places where people have dug their heels in some cases where we have dug our heels in our own communities, on our own reservations. And we need to go be good relatives with one another. You know, I want to say that was Ella Cara Deloria, the, you know, ethnographer that said that in speaking of Indians and then again in Dakota way of life. But right now, digging our heels in is not the answer. We're just getting more and more divided. I think if we live like Black Elk and we start and journey among those that we don't understand and become fully immersed, I think that this is the medicine that will heal America and move into other countries also.
Bobby, I like the way that you described how we collectively dig our heels in. And I think I am guilty of that too in my life. And it's something I need to be cognizant of and be open, as you suggest. So I'm really pleased that you are a part of this. Dr. Taylor, if you could, walk us through the schedule. It all begins Monday.
It does. It begins Monday, and Monday typically, so usually what we like to do is take advantage of all the plethora of things that already are going on campus. So, for example, Monday Morning Mission is an ecumenical service that we hold almost every Monday on campus, where all are welcome, and that's an opportunity for us to kind of kick off the Black Elk Convocation and Forum with not only letting the student body, faculty, staff, whoever's there know about the events that are coming up for the week, but also to present what's called the Mission Spotlight. And our Mission Spotlight is, again, to partner with Ministry on the Margins, which is a local organization that serves the poorest of the poor in our community, and invite those to participate with us on Tuesday morning and Thursday afternoon/evening for their food pantry. So that's kind of our kickoff on Monday. Tuesday would be the actual opportunity for service in the community. And we think that service is important to highlight because, as Bobby just really well pointed out, is that, you know, Black Elk is just a paragon, just an exemplar of ways in which you can walk among cultural groups and be that connector. And he really is that. And I say it in the present tense, because I believe his story, whenever shared, still brings people together and kind of unleashes that, I guess, where we're at on our heels, so to speak, that he mentioned also. Wednesday, we're going to feature the documentary on Black Elk, Walking the Good Red Road. This was produced only a few years ago on location at Pine Ridge. It's really well done. It highlights not only Black Elk's life as a Lakota healer, as a holy man, but also in his process of journeying both with his Lakota ways and his conversion to Catholicism. So it's really well done. It's just an hour. We'll feature that in the evening on campus and have some good discussion afterwards. Thursday will be another opportunity for more discussion about Black Elk. We've got a program called Late Night that's run by our chaplain, Father Dominic Bauk. And Bobby's been invited to come in and just share a little bit, but also to draw the student body and faculty and staff's attention to our convocation, which will host that 10 o'clock in the morning next Friday. And that is open to the public. It's right on campus at Butler Auditorium. And that'll go on for just about an hour. And then at noon, we'll kind of wrap up things. We always try to bring things together. It would be a mass in the Catholic tradition, but it's a mass to kind of pray, reflect, contemplate the process of canonization. So there's really good momentum building right now. We've got a lot of great partners and friends down in the Rapid City area who have been just really working hard on this. So it'll be a good time to just pause and take some reflective, prayerful time to pray and honor Black Elk during that time.
Bobby, does it surprise you the reaction that you get from young people when you speak, college students I'm speaking about, versus folks that are older, and how they respond to you, what it is that you say?
I'd say definitely in academic areas, it surprises me. When I serve with different, I spoke at BSC a while back, maybe several years ago, and I was talking about, you know, why we need to take into consideration things of ancestry and tribal. You know, we should be looking back to a book like Ecclesiastes that talks about what has been before. You know, what is here now has been before. So, you know, that looking back is important. And young people tend to really just focus on that, and you can see that their eyes are bright. So over 10 years ago, I used to serve as training coordinator for TSA North Dakota, the Transportation Security Administration here in North Dakota. And we could always tell when our adult learners were listening. You know, they had bright eyes. They were really focused. Their attending behavior was focused on the speaker. And I see that with young people more so than I see that with people that are older, you know. And so I think that there is something within young people that is almost wanting that right now. They're wanting to hear some of this ancestral wisdom, some of this traditional wisdom, if you will. And so the more they have these opportunities, I think that they're going to take advantage of them. You see people are starting to return to, I noticed, to the Catholic Church. They're starting to return to the Orthodox Church. Young people are wanting to know what was before what we have right now. And so I think that if we, as those that are a little older than them, you know, they, I don't understand, but they think 50 is old. I don't.
I've seen your picture, Bobby. I don't know that you look like you're 50 either, by the way.
I know, and I hang out at the Y a lot, so all the older guys there are like, you're just a young pup. Don't even start. I mean, hey, man, it's the young people that are saying that. But as a guy that's just starting, you know, I've just started my, the phase where I take the first part of life. So those seven phases, 49 years, and I pull it together and I prepare for these next 7 years to become an elder. It takes that long to try to figure it out, you know. I want to make sure that I've done my due diligence and that I'm being a good relative. So in the best way, according to Jim Quick, has a podcast called Quick Brain. He says the best way to learn something is to teach it, because you get to learn it twice. And so I'm always trying to talk to young people, and young people are the ones that are listening right now, which tells me that there's an opportunity here all over the world. And if we're paying attention and we are just giving them something to consider, and we approach it in a respectful way, I really believe that we're going to be pleasantly pleased with what young people are going to give us in this time of human history where there's so much tumult, you know.
Is the entire forum open to the public at large?
Absolutely. I mean, at the University of Mary, we're always trying to be good Benedictine hosts. I mean, hospitality is one of the primary values of Benedictine communities. So absolutely, all the events are open and accessible. We're always pleased when we can make that invitation and have people from the general community come. And, you know, it's very interesting with this forum is that people do come. You know, I've talked to folks from all over the world that have had various events surrounding Black Elk, and the people that come with very particular interests, some of which, even to the speaker, and I found this myself, are things that you would have not even known, even if you, you know, spend as much time in research and in story and in communication with others about a person like Black Elk, for example. There's always something new. And lately for myself, I've learned that in the story of John Neihardt. I could talk about that for hours because I've been on quite a journey learning about him as the author of Black Elk Speaks. And I think that's the beauty also of Black Elk is akin to an onion, layers just keep coming off. And every single layer is significant not only in the historical context, but today as we address issues of cultural healing, of renewal, of what Bobby just mentioned with young people. And if I could, I just wanted to say that I think pedagogically, I'll just put in that word because I'm an educator, we're getting a little better at embracing story as a way of learning. And there's no richer community on this planet than the Native American community in terms of story. And I think that's something that's been offered and continues to be offered. It's just a matter of, are we open to accepting and embracing, you know, the value of story, not only to understanding a culture better historically, but today, and then how we can engage in that. Because I think while some cultures really have that par excellence, I think we all have it in our DNA as storytellers. And my goodness, since I've moved to North Dakota, North Dakotans are phenomenal storytellers. So that exchange alone, you know, when, and Bobby's been there when we've had really good dialogue around Black Elk, like for example at the Heritage Center, where we shifted it from kind of discussions and platitudes about certain maybe kind of ideological things around culture to let's talk about this person's story. All of a sudden we hear other people's stories in concert with a story like Black Elk's story. That's where I think the genius of the cultural healing comes in, is because now we're looking at a person with an exemplary life and making connections. And I think we can do that. And when we do that, I think that's when the healing tends to go.
Where can we learn more about the forum, Dr. Taylor?
You're welcome to go to umary.edu, umary.edu. And we'll have information there. Folks are always welcome to contact me as well. And I'm always happy, especially when people are trying to kind of navigate our campus or navigate a particular thing that they see on the schedule that they want to be involved on. I'm always ready, willing, and able to help anybody that wants to access to. And if they can't access the forum, just that exchange. Mm. Because, again, every time we do this, every time there's something surrounding Black Elk, something new and really valuable and fruitful comes out of the dialogue.
Dr. Michael Taylor is the Professor of Education and Director of Catholic Studies for the Graduate Education Program at the University of Mary. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Bobby Gray Eagle is a Dakota man and a speaker who will be featured at the University of Mary's Black Elk Convocation and Forum, which begins Monday, October 7th, and lasts through the week it ends, Friday, October 11th. Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today on Main Street.
Yes, it was an honor and privilege. Thank you.
After the break, Rick Gion and I will discuss the best regional apple festivals in our latest Prairie Place segment. Stick around.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All right.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's our music. It must be Wednesday. Last week we were with Rick on Tuesday, but now we're back to our normal rhythm of Wednesdays and another edition of Prairie Plates. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
Good to be with you, Craig.
There's lots and lots of ways we can celebrate the harvest season. One of those ways is to celebrate apple harvest festivals, and there are several in the region. Let our listeners know what a good apple harvest festival is.
Well, I think it really evolves around food, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about it because that's what I do on this show, and we have fun every week. So yes, just apples in a variety of situations, whether it be regular cider, hard cider, apple pies, you know, there's strudels, there's all sorts of things that you can make with apples. They're just very versatile, sweet and savory. Yeah, and I actually did a little bit of research from NDSU Extension, which we can talk about a little more. I'm not a botanist, I'm just an expert eater, but I did a little apple research too.
First of all, do you have any family traditions where apples play prominent? And I'll tell you ours. The only one I can think of is on Halloween. Our kids will tell you that we have pizza and apple cider. And now that they have gone their separate ways, it's still a little tradition that they still maintain. And the apple cider is what I look forward to at Halloween for some reason. I think my mom and dad kind of started that in our home. And then I also use apple cider to cook with, especially with ribs. I just think it really adds a lot of flavor.
Yeah, and back to what makes a good Apple Harvest Festival, I think, is, well, obviously the food we talked about, but music, games, vendors, just that sort of thing. It's family friendly usually, which I think is really nice. People are always looking for things to do with their children.
If not as fun doing it by ourselves as it is going to a festival, and you were at one just recently, Rick.
This past weekend at Wild Terra, which is in downtown Fargo, not too far away from the Prairie Public Studio here, I attended, I was there for about an hour or so, just kind of hanging out, seeing what's going on. They had some apple pressing demonstrations, which were pretty neat, a couple of food trucks, which were very good, some tacos, and then Namaste Kitchen, which is always very good with like non-tacos, samosas, that sort of thing. I don't think she had anything with apples, but a lot of vendors, music. There was a band called Kohlrabi Soup, which I think is a really neat name, and they're kind of a bluegrass sort of thing. But yeah, Wild Terra, definitely a unique destination stop in Fargo. They make their own ciders. They do pizzas at night. It's a very eclectic, fun, unique place that people just love it here. So yes, that was a lot of fun. I've been doing grad school stuff, so I hopefully can make it to more of these Apple Harvest festivals, but I don't think so.
You talked about one that happened in Bismarck, September 22nd, Apple Jam at Buckstop Junction.
There have been a few so far in September, and that's when they usually take place, so I'll probably miss them anyway. But yeah, Apple Jam at Buckstop Junction, which is just kind of on the edge of Bismarck, and that had a lot of things going on September 22nd. So a lot of music, like all day long, a long list of food trucks, craft vendors. It was family friendly. It really looked like a blast. If I was out in Bismarck, I probably would have stopped by and hung out for a while. It just looked like a really fun event. And Buckstop Junction, if you've been there, is kind of the old school buildings, kind of like Bonanzaville in West Fargo. So definitely a neat event. Another one recently in Ellendale Apple Fest, and that's a huge community event. I mean, you have like a 5K, you have a big parade, you have a rib cook-off, which, well, who doesn't like ribs?
That.
Yes. An apple pie contest and vendors, a lot of vendors and music, street dance included in that. So, oh, and by the way, the one at event at Wild Terra had a pie-eating contest for kids.
And that, fun.
It was really fun, and this one little guy was just stuffing his face.
These are apple pies they're eating, right?
Apple pies, and they just had kind of a time limit to eat a couple or one or whatever, and this little guy just really nailed it. He was stuffing it in, and he really cleaned up. So, congratulations to him, and anyway, yeah, a lot of contests, a lot of apple pie contests, eating contests, that sort of thing. The rib contest I'm very interested in. And, you know, one thing about that, too, is like for your mop sauce for ribs and barbecue, that apple cider vinegar can be quite good.
Mm.
And then also, yes, a sauce made with like applesauce or apple juice, cider, that sort of thing. You're definitely on the right track there.
The growing season's a little bit shorter, but you can still grow apples here in North Dakota for sure.
You can. And I did a little research via NDSU Extension, and they listed actually 17 apples,
wow.
apple varieties that are good to grow in North Dakota, 17 varieties. But the two most popular, and people will recognize these, are Harrelson and Honeycrisp. Harrelson, they described as the standard for cooking, which makes a lot of sense if you're making pies and that sort of thing. And then Honeycrisp, they said, was just the most popular. I think it's a really delicious apple myself. If you can really get the timing right on it with the frost and that sort of thing, that can really be good. And then there was one that was called Hazen, and I'm guessing that it's named after the town of Hazen, which would be pretty cool. I also looked on the University of Minnesota Extension website, and they talked about some of these same apples and then mentioned, obviously, the Harrelson and Honeycrisp. So a lot of apples can be grown up here, which is interesting. And one application I'd like to talk about is a cider house that's just west of Fargo here near Ayer, North Dakota, called Cottonwood Cider House. And they're probably open another couple weeks or something like that, but they have a lot of really good hard ciders, and they have food on the weekends. I think it's just Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then a brunch on Sunday. That's amazing. People posted on my Facebook group, and it's just, it's kind of a destination spot, and this food looks really, really good. So
yeah, I was looking at their website, Rick. They're open Fridays from 6 to 9, Saturdays from 1 to 9, and Sundays 10 to 4. And they serve breakfast and lunch on Sundays from 10 to 4. The kitchen closes at 2, and the tap room closes at 4. But I saw that in your notes. I looked at it earlier, and I think that we just might try to bounce out there this Friday night. So I might have a firsthand report for you.
That would be great. And post it on my Facebook group, because there's about 41,000 people on that group now, and they're all very interested in the hot spots around Fargo Moorhead. Sure. And the surrounding area. So,
do you have a favorite type of apple, Rick, before we go?
You know, I kind of like the sweeter apples, like the Fuji, and that's those sorts of things that I buy at the regular grocery store. For cooking, I do like a green apple or a tartar apple, which there's quite a few varieties out there, because the sweet apples just kind of disintegrate, or they're just too sweet for the application. But I don't know. I do like apples. It's a good food.
Granny Smiths are my go-to.
There you go.
We use them for cooking, and we can also use them for snacking. It just seems to work for all those applications. Rick, fall is just a fun time of year, isn't it?
It really is, and there's actually a fall fest coming up at the Red River Market this Saturday in downtown Fargo. So, yeah, fall is great. I'm guessing they'll have it decorated up with pumpkins and hay bales and that sort of stuff.
I got to carve my pumpkin still. I usually go all out, so I'm going to have to see what we're going to do this year.
I look forward to seeing it.
All right, I'll get pictures for you, Rick. We've been with Rick Dion for our weekly edition of Prairie Plates. Rick, thank you so much for joining us again on Main Street.
You're welcome, Craig.
Tour the studios of some of Fargo Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See new and returning artists demonstrating their work. New destinations this year include the Indigenous Art Collaboration at the Plains Art Museum. And the Rourke Art Gallery is offering tours of their public access print studio and hosting several area artists in their courtyard outside. Find the studio crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Get ready for an inspiring evening of deep reflection and meaningful conversation with Kate Bowler. She'll be at the Avalon Events Center in Fargo on October 10th from 7 to 9 o'clock. She is a Duke professor and says that she is a friendly neighborhood Canadian. How can you go wrong with that? Joining me to discuss the event is my co-host. Oh, wait. That was our former life. Ashley Thornburg is with me to discuss. She's now the program manager and podcast host for Humanities North Dakota. Ashley, welcome back to Main Street.
Well, thanks for having me. Fun to be on this end of the microphone.
The last time you and I spoke, you were also on the other end of the microphone, but now you've marched on. You're doing work for Humanities ND, and this event is coming up October 10th. What drew Humanities North Dakota to invite Kate Bowler for this Brave Conversations event? And we'll talk more about what Brave Conversation is, but How does she align with the goals of the series?
Sure. Well, the goals of the series are, you know, especially focusing in on that word brave. What does it mean to be brave? And we like to think that there is a lot of great bravery that is involved in having deep, meaningful conversations. And as you mentioned, she is a divinity professor. She's also a cancer survivor and a mother. And she heard a lot of things in her healing journey, like everything happens for a reason. And while those are very nice messages that can leave us wanting a little bit more in terms of understanding the stories that we tell ourselves and what that means to be a human. And that's really what the humanities focus on, is the fields that study the human condition, things like philosophy, religion, history, literature. And so she really aligns with that because, well, she is very much aligned with religion as a divinity professor. And then just talking about culture and the stories that we tell ourselves and how her cancer journey impacted her work.
Ashley, give us a feel for the format of this event. What can our audience expect? And then what do you hope they take away from listening and then interacting with Kate?
Sure. Well, what I really love about the Brave Conversations series is that we hear from thought-provoking, intriguing, and engaging people, just like you would at many other speaking engagements. But the difference with Humanities North Dakota is we're all sitting at a round table. And at every single round table is a trained conversation facilitator. You know what it's like, Craig, to have difficult conversations and to guide people through them. So something like Kate Buller's topic, we're talking about mortality. We're talking about the impact on our faith journeys and on our families. So these are topics that, they get a little scary when we try to think of them all by ourselves. But coming together with a trained conversation facilitator, listening to her talk, and then getting to discuss, this really made me uncomfortable. I wonder what's going on there. Sharing that with the table, and then you sort of find that you're not very alone. Usually, if you are worried about something or scared about something or anxious, and we find that people walk away from events like Brave Conversations feeling a lot more engaged and hopeful than when they came in.
Ashley, what would you tell someone who, okay, this sounds really good, I would like to hear her speak, but I am really nervous about sitting at a table with some people that I don't know? Yeah, Ashley said there are trained facilitators. Okay, but oh my gosh, I just don't like to share. What would you tell those folks?
Yeah, well, that's part of why we call it Brave Conversations, is trying to realize that we are more brave than we think. And again, it kind of goes back to hearing somebody else say something that you might feel a lot less alone in. For example, I volunteered for Humanities before I worked for them, and there was a discussion at an event in April about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there was someone at the table who didn't feel like she could really say specific words or have a question because it wasn't a race that she belonged to, and she just didn't even know what words to use. And just like you said, didn't really want to share, didn't really want to open up, pretty reticent. The conversation facilitators usually take on that role of being the most vulnerable person right away. And then that opens up the doors. Somebody else confessed a vulnerability or a fear, and then you could just feel the table open up right away. And then it led to a lot more engaging of a conversation, and just to be able to realize that we all struggle sometimes understanding the complexities of the world that we live in. And so it really is helpful because you feel so much less alone. We really thrive on creating that connection between lifelong learners.
I think the word safe space is often trivialized, Ashley, but I'm sure you really tried to apply that here and with an event, especially like this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, just knowing that other people are there who might be having some of the same issues or concerns that you have. And then I think it also helps that the speaker has been up there and been really vulnerable right away. So you've been sitting for 20, 30, 40 minutes, however long the speaker has been talking and hearing. You know, you're going to hear Kay Buller talk about having an 18-month-old son, one that she and her husband really struggled to conceive, and not even be able to pick him up at times. She was so weak in her cancer treatments. And I think we can all relate to that fear of not being there for the people that we love the most.
Ashley, in the broader context of humanities, why is it important today? And how do you align your guests with conversations you feel are humanities ND feels are relevant for North Dakota?
We are all still humans, even though AI is certainly doing a lot for us. You know, we are still humans, and that ability that we have to think and to feel, and the connection that comes from being a human. And it's no easy thing. I love one of the titles of Kate Buller's books, No Cure for Being Human. Right away, the recognition that, it's hard. Sure, it's beautiful at times, but it's also really hard at times to be a human. But there's also no cure for it. We have to get through these things together. And the humanities help us to understand ourselves, our motivations, different ways to explore meaning. A lot of it starts with that everybody on staff really lives up to the missions and the values that we have at Humanities North Dakota. Kindness, good faith, the intellectual curiosity, and free exchange of ideas. And we often find that we are drawn to speakers that we might not necessarily agree with personally, and realize that part of the work that we do as humans and understanding the human condition is trying to figure out what motivates me, what motivates somebody else, how are we both understanding life's journeys and the different ways that we can find meaning and connection in the world. And so we are listening to our members. This specific idea came to us from a woman named Jackie Stebbins, who has actually been on Main Street before, talking about a condition that she had and the illness that she dealt with and how it impacted her understanding of work and meaning and life and family. And so this was somebody that she was following. So it kind of comes from a range of places, whether it's listening to our members, our board members, the people of North Dakota. And then also we are connected with humanities scholars across the country. And so we can kind of be tapping in to some of those speakers.
Ashley, we have a short time left. What's coming up for Humanities ND?
Well, that event, again, October 10th, 7 to 9 p.m. Another event that I'm really looking forward to, this one's going to be in May in Bismarck, is a guy named Kay He, and he was making millions on Wall Street and, you know, made all his childhood goals and then ended up leaving because he realized he wasn't happy. Money is one thing, but it's not everything. So that's another in-person event. I'm very excited about the upcoming public university programs. These are classes that are free for members or a small registration fee for non-members that, you know, we have ones coming up that help us to talk about Islam and the role of Islam in shaping modern culture, even in places that aren't heavily of that faith. And we also have one on understanding Norwegian culture and the Mandan, Nuetta, and Hidatsa people. So it's a really nice mix of history, of literature, of global affairs. Chances are very good you will find some kind of program that really aligns with your personal values and your learning style at humanitiesnd.org.
And as Ashley reminded us, Dr. Kay Moeller is a four-time New York Times award-winning best-selling author. She's a friendly Canadian. She's also an associate professor of American religious history at Duke University, and she will be speaking October 10th at the Avalon Event Center, hosted by Humanities ND and as part of their Brave Conversation series. Ashley Thornburg, the program manager and podcast host for Humanities ND, sounds weird to say though, has been my guest. Ashley, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks, Greg.
And just a quick note to add, you'll be able to listen to that Humanities ND Brave Conversation event with Kate Buller, either via live stream or at a Minot satellite event. We'll have the links to each of those on our website at prairiepublic.org. Look at the Main Street section.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 2nd. Lisbon, located in the beautiful Cheyenne River Valley of southeastern North Dakota, is home to a historic post office building built in 1939. Within that history is the story of a lost sculpture. During President Franklin D. Roosevelt's administration, Lisbon received $85,000 from the New Deal in 1938 to build a new post office, which was completed in 1939. Federal funds covered the cost of the site, the construction of the building, and landscaping. Between 1930 and 1940, eight other North Dakota towns, including Langdon, New Rockford, and Rugby, also received federal funds for new post offices. These four towns were authorized to include decorative art in their new buildings. On this date, in 1939, Time magazine published an article about how the Works Progress Administration and the U.S. Treasury Department allocated money to artists for murals and other artwork for New Deal building projects. The post offices in Langdon, New Rockford, and Rugby each received a mural painting. Lisbon, however, received a sculpture through the Treasury Department's Section of Fine Arts, as new post offices fell under the U.S. Treasury Department's control. In 1942, a young California artist named James Lee Hansen received an $850 contract to create a sculpture titled Family Group, which celebrated the strength of North Dakota families. Hansen had made a name for himself by winning a major competition 3 years earlier to sculpt a limestone statue of young Abraham Lincoln for the new U.S. courthouse in Los Angeles, earning $7,200 for that sculpture. Hansen completed the family group sculpture for the Lisbon Library in 1943. Using terracotta, unglazed brownish-red earthenware, he crafted a reclining mother and father with a young child standing between them, all with expressions of sincere devotion to each other. The sculpture measured 7 feet 6 inches in length and 2 feet 9 inches in height. Unfortunately, due to World War II, the sculpture was never installed. Legend has it that the family group pieces were stored in the Lisbon Post Office basement for 30 years. In 1972, the artwork was reportedly relocated to Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, under the auspices of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Elisa Underly Nelson joins us from South Dakota, where she recently experienced the Buffalo Roundup at Custer State Park. This annual event draws thousands of visitors for an incredible spectacle of buffalo management. We'll also hear from Matt O'Lean and his movie review of Megalopolis. We look forward to having you back with us tomorrow, right here on Main Street.